Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the podcast, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. If you're already a weirdo, please share the podcast with others. Doing so helps make it possible for me to keep doing the podcast. And while listening, be sure to check out the Weird Darkness website so you can find me on social media and drop me an email. This is a Weekend Archives episode, previously aired December 8, 2018, and I believe originally aired before that. The episode has three stories of the creepypasta genre. Unfortunately, the original show notes to this episode have been lost to some type of internet interdimensional sinkhole, so they won't be complete. But the audio is still intact, which means I can still share it with you. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. Lady in White by Paul Spangler. The year was 1977, and it was a lovely but chilly fall evening. I was 11 years old and was quite an avid watcher of the TV show In Search Of. I remember watching an episode about ghosts and spirits a few months back and had mentioned it to my grandfather while staying overnight. Grandma wasn't too keen of my interest in the spirit world, but my grandfather was very enthused. He said he had a very special ghost story to tell me. My grandmother yawned and said, "Well, I'm off to bed." I hugged and kissed her on the cheek, we exchanged good nights, and she went down the hallway to the bedroom. It was a Friday night, so I was allowed to stay up late. The fireplace was crackling as Grandpa put another log on the fire and turned the main lights off with only one small lamp on now. With a warm glow cast throughout the room, Grandfather began to tell me a story that would stay with me forever. Clearing his throat, "Now you see, I was only a youngster when I first heard of her. Must have been back in 1932 or 33. Now, this takes place in 1918, just as World War I was winding down. Many troops were getting ready to come back to the America's shores. This young lady by the name Andrea Lynn Jones was a very beautiful and charming blonde-haired lady of 19 years old. She was, in fact, the most beautiful young lady in the country. She had a fiancé that had been drafted to go over to France to fight in the Big One, as it was called back then. Now, Andrea was so delighted that her love was returning and that they'd be married soon. It was all she could talk about. The whole community was abuzz with their wedding plans. Her father owned one of the biggest stores in town, and it would be the social event of the year. She and her mother had sewn a wedding dress for the very special occasion. Invitations had been mailed to well over 100 people. She was counting the days till his troop ship would arrive. Finally, his ship departed France and arrived in New York City Harbor a few days later. He now had to just make the train ride back to Indiana. He'd sent a telegram, which Andrea had read over and over. Andrea, being so nervous with excitement, she could not sleep that night knowing he was to arrive very soon. The dawn, now appearing, she had but a few hours to go before his train would be pulling into the station at 9 a.m. She readied herself, and not wanting to wait on her parents, she left on horseback, arriving at the station early. She sat, anticipating the moment she had long dreamed of these past months, and prayed about her fiancé's return from the battle-torn fields of Europe. She had daydreamed of him taking her into his arms and holding her so close so many times. She was now looking anxiously down the tracks, as were others. It was almost 9 a.m. Then it was 9:15. No train yet. She was starting to worry, pacing back and forth along the platform. Maybe there was a mistake about the arrival time. She walked to the railroad office. The men inside were talking frantically amongst one another. Many had puzzled looks on their taut faces. She sensed something was wrong. She motioned for one of the men to come over to the window. Just then, a man came running up, shouting. The train had derailed, and many passengers were hurt. She was in shock. Then she exclaimed, "No, not my Theodore! No, he must be okay!" Other people waiting on the platform voiced their concern as well. Word was spreading quickly. More news was coming in. The train had derailed about 15 miles away. Volunteers were being called up. Andrea, being concerned, wanted to go with them, but she was told to stay at the station. Several men in two flatbed trucks took off on the dirt road parallel to the railroad tracks heading north. She felt a sinking feeling in her chest. She was having trouble breathing. She prayed that Theodore would be okay. It was almost half past 11 a.m. now. Finally, men were coming back. One truck could be seen in the distance. Andrea was so nervous, wringing her hands. Her mother and father had arrived about 30 minutes ago. They tried to calm her fears about Theodore. "He'll be okay, dear," her mother said as she put her hands on her shoulders. "Yes, a strong young man like Theodore," said her father. His stern, wise features seemed to reinforce this. "All that he's been through, the battles and the hardships, yes, he'll be fine," he said. Andrea smiled, saying, "Yes, you're right, father." The truck was now near the station. It was full of people. Everyone seemed dazed. The town doctor, as well as others, gathered near the truck. Andrea leapt up and ran to the truck. She looked frantically, her eyes darting here and there. "Where is Theodore?" "Theodore!" she exclaimed, and then shouted again, "Theodore!" yet again. She began climbing into the truck. She thought she saw him lying near the cab of the truck, but it wasn't him. "He's not here," she said under her breath. A man approached her. "Young lady," he shouted, "there's another truck yet to return." She thanked him and climbed down from the truck. The man helped her down. She walked over to her parents, telling them Theodore must be on the other truck. The agonizing minutes ticked by slowly. Then finally, the other truck could be seen approaching the station, dust flying up behind it. Her heart pounded rapidly. She tensed, praying with her eyes closed. The truck pulled up near the station. Some people started to exit the bed of the truck. She ran to the truck. As she approached the truck, she knew something was wrong. She caught sight of several other hurt people, and then one body covered with a heavy blanket. She did not see Theodore among the people who climbed from the bed of the truck. The town doctor approached her. She turned and said, "Theodore Smith, is he okay?" Her hesitant voice strained. "Is he still at the site of the accident?" "Yes, there are others, but..." Her parents walked up just now. Andrea's eyes tensed. The doctor said, "I'm sorry. So sorry. Everyone was alive except..." Andrea's heart was in her throat. The doctor said reluctantly, "Theodore had passed." Andrea stood there in complete shock. She felt her legs give way, and her father grabbed her and held her up. The doctor and her father carried her to the bench by the ticket office. The doctor checked her pulse. She had merely passed out. The doctor put smelling salts under her nose. She awoke, startled. She was in a terrible state, starting to scream and cry, her mother trying to console her. They took her home soon afterward. The doctor then gave her a sleeping powder, and that evening, Andrea slept soundly with visions of Theodore in her dreams. Andrea awoke early the next morning. The sun was shining brightly with a clear sky. Andrea's father had already left, and her mother was out in the front yard. She dressed and proceeded quietly out the back door, walking about 4 miles to the nearest railroad tracks. She waited patiently as a chill ran up and down her spine, her keen blue eyes staring down the tracks into the distance. In a few moments, she heard the locomotive blow its whistle, a most mournful, chilling sound. She stared toward the heavens and could see her Theodore, handsome as always, smiling at her. The train appeared in the distance. It was but a mere speck on the horizon. As the moments passed, it grew larger and larger. Andrea could see it clearly now. She then felt a hand cover her eyes. She quickly turned around to see Theodore. She beamed with a huge smile. "My love, you've come for me!" Theodore smiled and embraced her. The train now closing faster. Andrea standing a mere 2 feet from the track as the locomotive grew closer and closer. It began blowing its whistle again. Theodore now grabbing her by the hands and pulling her toward him again. They embraced and kissed as they stepped onto the tracks, locked in eternal embrace. Poor Andrea was struck and thrown like a rag doll through the air. She'd been hit by a 20-ton locomotive pulling 20 cars. It was a most horrific sight to behold. The engineer was as white as a sheet as he screeched to a halt to inspect what had happened. Andrea had been dressed in her beautiful wedding gown, now soaked with splashes of bright crimson. Her body twisted and broken, lying in the pasture by the tracks. I just stared at my grandfather. You see, Thomas, she just could not stand to be without the love of her life. Love can have such a strong bond, especially when it's between two young people. Well, several years passed from that tragic day. Then stories began to be told and retold about the vision of a young, beautiful lady standing by the tracks. It seemed she made herself seen along the stretch of B&O line in our area, which covers many miles and several lines of track. She'd appear with a faint glow around her. The way the stories would always go, if you see her by the tracks, you better slow down and be careful. Something was amiss. Well, back in 32 or 33, she saved a locomotive from derailing, and in 45 she helped an eastbound freight avoid some washed-out tracks. When I started working the line after World War II, we were always told to heed the lady in white. I interjected, "So did you ever see her, Granddad?" "Well, yes, I did. And you're here because of her. There was a faulty switch on the tracks, and there could have been a collision, but all was avoided just in time, too. Your dad was born a year later, and if not for her, I would have been killed for sure." Granddad patted my head. "Yes, you can thank the lady in white for you being born." "So is she still out there?" I said in a somewhat shaky voice. "Oh yes, I'd say so. She has an eternity to save others. I think it's her way to make amends for taking her own life. A second chance for her to do good deeds. She couldn't save poor Theodore, so she helps others." This story has stuck with me all these years, and every time I hear a train in the distance, I can't help but think of her and whisper, "Thank you, Lady in White."
Join us for the Weirdo Watch Party as we watch The Frozen Dead, hosted by horror host Bobby Gamonster, Saturday night, January 30th at 9 p.m. Central.
Haven't aged a day in 20 years.
But do you know that one has not survived? And seven are mental cases.
Top war criminals frozen alive at the height of their power, waiting for the moment when science will free them from their icy tombs to take vengeance against the world. And that moment is now.
Is there anything you require?
Yes. Impossible. A live brain.
Another victim sacrificed to feed the inhuman needs of the frozen dead. Starring Dana Andrews as the scientist who tries in vain to wash the blood from his hand.
Matt! All of you!
A network of murderers, dedicated to a monstrous project. Beware the icy stare of the frozen dead.
That's 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Mountain, 10 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. in Hawaii, and for those of you on Greenwich Mean Time, January 31st at 2 a.m. The movie's free, Bobby Gamonster's always funny, and you know the merrymaking that takes place in the chat room during our Weirdo Watch Parties. So join us for the next Weirdo Watch Party on the Weirdo Watch Party page at WeirdDarkness.com, Saturday, January 30th at 9 p.m. Central. Get the times again, see a trailer for the movie The Frozen Dead, or learn more about the Weirdo Watch Party at WeirdDarkness.com.
Kingdom Come by George Catronis. Christopher felt the beginning of a migraine coming on. He absentmindedly reached into the drawer of his desk for the bottle of scotch. The storm had been gathering for hours, the black clouds looming over the city. "This one's going to be a good one," he thought, and took a swill from the bottle. Out of habit, he looked towards the study's open door. His wife didn't like seeing him drinking like this. She said it made her think of her alcoholic father, always sneaking off to get a drink. He met him once at Thanksgiving. He used to store bottles all around the house and take sips whenever he got a chance, his wife said. He put the bottle down on the desk and stared out the window. The raindrops landing there came slow but steady. He looked at the backyard and hoped that the rain wouldn't flood the basement again. He was ashamed to realize how old and worrisome he'd become. This wasn't like him, worrying about weather and his precious basement. Hell, rain never put a dent in his plans, even if they included a trip to the beach. Rain was rain, nothing to be bothered by, nothing to ruin your day. But that was a long time ago. These days, his left knee hurt whenever the weather got wet. He left the study and went downstairs to the kitchen. His wife was out today, giving him some much-needed me time to try and get some work done. He opened the fridge and grabbed a bottle of water and an apple. His diet was another thing that was different these days – doctor's orders. He took a bite out of the apple and went over to the couch to watch some TV. There was a breaking news segment about a storm hitting the East Shore. It looked bad. After Katrina, people got skittish when the weather turned like this, to the point when you never knew if the news reports were honest or bullshit. He decided it was the latter, put his feet up on the table, and after a while, fell asleep. When he woke up, night had fallen and the storm was raging outside. He glanced at the clock on the kitchen counter and rubbed his eyes. It was late in the afternoon. He wondered if his wife had come home and found him sleeping, but the dark house told him that wasn't the case. He got up and called out after his wife, but got no reply. She was probably visiting one of her friends. Didn't she say something about that? I guess I should have listened more closely, he thought, as he walked around the house, turning on the lights. His knee was acting up, forcing him to walk with a limp. "Getting old," he said to the empty house. Somehow saying it out loud made it worse. He looked outside from one of the windows, but he couldn't see much. He decided it was time to call Helen and find out where she was. He had to get dinner started and maybe she could pick up a movie from the video store. It wasn't often they got a night alone at home with each other. He picked up the phone and dialed his wife's cell phone. The voice on the other end of the line said the number couldn't be reached. He hung up. He thought about calling his daughter, but she was two states away, and he'd only succeed in making her worry, like he was now. He probably should have called her earlier. She was supposed to be back hours ago. Maybe the storm took down some trees and the roads were closed off. He opened the front door and was impressed by the strength of the wind. There was a minivan parked on their driveway, the minivan his wife drove. So she did get home. The headlights and overhead lights weren't on. He waited to see if his wife would get out of the car, but there was no movement. Then he noticed how strange the rain looked when it fell. He turned the light towards the minivan, which was now somehow painted black instead of the original deep blue it was when they bought it 2 years ago. Even the windshield and the windows were dark. The sight was absurd, the darkness and the storm making it really hard to see, but he was sure this was their car. The plate numbers matched, and who would have parked the same car in a different color on their driveway anyway? He was about to make a run for the car, but something about the rain made him think twice. Then he saw the bird. It must have been a sparrow, but Jack didn't know what the hell it was now. It was completely covered by whatever the rain was carrying, and it was struggling to take flight. Long strands of black matter were stretching between its feathers and the ground. It looked like a bird trapped in oil, unable to spread its wings or move. It looked like the rain was trying to eat it. He went back inside and put on a jacket and a raincoat. He made a run for the minivan. He tried to avoid the puddles of black that were everywhere on his front yard. Whatever it was, it didn't prove too difficult to walk on, nor was it as sticky as he feared. He ran to the car and used one gloved hand to throw open the driver's side door. The car was empty. There were shopping bags on the passenger seat, but nothing else. Then he noticed the smears of black on the upholstery and on the steering wheel. His heart sunk. Christopher ran back to the porch and shook off the raincoat. He looked out across the street and called after his wife. There was no reply. He called after her a few more times, his panic mounting. None of this made sense. The house was just a few feet from the car. Where could she have gone? He took off his shoes and clothes and let them fall on the wooden floor of the porch. He didn't want to bring whatever covered them into his house. Once inside, he sat down, trying to ignore the panicked voice in his head that threatened to send him running outside screaming. He tried to figure out what was going on, what that black matter could be. Chemical warfare? He tried the phone again, but it wasn't working. He turned on the TV, but the only thing he was getting on all channels was the emergency broadcast message amid the screeching beeps and tones designed to get your attention. The Office of Civil Defense has issued the following message. This is an event warning. This is an event warning. Event warning means that an unspecified environmental disaster has been detected. Important instructions will follow in 30 seconds. This warning applies to all areas receiving this message. Immediately seek shelter. The safest place to be during an event is in a basement. If no basement is available, seek shelter in the lowest floor of the building. Remember to stay away from window. Turned it off. He had a wife and daughter somewhere out there, and he was supposed to just stay inside? He paced the house and looked out the windows, but there were no signs of her. He could see a fire somewhere downtown, but couldn't make out which buildings were burning. He sat down and put his head in his hands, unable to think clearly, feeling the migraine coming on again. Whenever he got one, he was unable to do anything besides lie down and keep a pillow over his eyes to shut out any kind of light. He tried to calm down. He could hold it at bay if he didn't get too worked up. He went upstairs and sat on their bed. Their bed, the one they'd shared for 25 years now. He knew something was wrong, that there was no logical reason for his wife to be wandering outside in this weather. No reason her car would be parked 20 steps from the house, unlocked and empty. Something was wrong. But there wasn't much he could do except sit there and try and keep his headache at bay. A sound came from above, like something scraping against the roof. They didn't have any trees that tall, and he had never heard a sound like it before. They didn't have an attic. Almost against his will, he got up and approached the window. He opened it a bit, holding it against the wind that threatened to throw it open against the wall. The sound of the storm was now much stronger, much closer to him. The air didn't smell the way it usually did when it rained. This rain, it carried something different. It smelled like ashes. There, outside his second floor bedroom window, 20 feet off the ground, was his wife. He recognized her even though she was completely covered by the dark matter that was still falling on her, drop by drop. He could see the red top she had left the house in that morning peeking from underneath the dark, and he could recognize the large hoop earrings he bought her as a gift on their last vacation. Her mouth and eyes were shut, covered by the oily substance. She was knocking on the window like she wanted to be let inside. When Jack didn't move, she flew in, crashing through the window. Her movement was erratic but effortless. The window exploded inwards, scattering pieces of glass and wood around the room. She flew in, her feet still not touching the floor, just her toes dragging lightly against the wood. She shrieked. Then, before his eyes, the flesh of her forearms split open, and a pair of fanged maws like those of a Venus flytrap protruded from her flesh. Within them, a dozen black tendrils flailed wildly, reaching out to him. Jack frantically tried to keep her from touching him, falling in his desperate attempt to get away from the thing that used to be his wife. He scuttled on the floor like an insect until his back hit the closet door, and he just sat there, looking up at the thing. It spoke, its voice like gravel scraping against cement, like its teeth were all broken and floating around in its mouth. "I can't see," it said. Jack winced at the sound, which still carried something of his wife's voice. He crawled towards the door, but the thing seemed to hear him and moved closer to him, so he stopped.
"Make a sound, baby. Call my name so I can find you. Please," the thing said, as if trying to imitate the personality that once belonged to the body it occupied.
The hairs on his neck stood up. He tried to think of a way out, but couldn't see how he could escape the room without letting the creature know where he was. The tendrils were now feeling their way around the room, touching the bed and the walls of the bedroom, leaving behind dark smears. He bolted out the door as fast as he could. The creature whipped its head around at surprising speed, and one of the tendrils managed to grab his ankle. The searing pain traveled along his leg and up to his spine, but in his panicked state, he managed to kick it loose. He stumbled free and out into the corridor. He took the steps, two at a time, grasping the banister with both hands. He reached the landing and looked back to see this thing levitating at the top of the staircase. He heard a sound behind him, something scraping at the front door trying to get in. He didn't dare to think what stood behind that door, but knew that escape route was closed off. He ran into the kitchen and grabbed a knife from the holder. He didn't know what good it would do, but he felt better holding a weapon. The pain in his leg was still present, but was beginning to fade. He knew he could get out of this if he just had time to think this through, but time was one of the things he didn't have. The creature shrieked in the living room, joining the wail of whatever was outside the door, a mix of human crying and a howl. He remembered that his neighbors had a dog, a mean Rottweiler they kept in their backyard, and he prayed to God that what he feared wasn't true. One of those things with four legs and the ability to outrun him would mean his death. He hid behind one of the counters, trying to gain some time, but the creature was already there.
"Come be with us, Jack. Come be with your family."
That sibilant voice again, like the sound of sand being carried by waves. He knew what it was trying to do, but it terrified him that it was smart enough to try and deceive him by using his love for his family. It was smarter than he thought. God knows how smart it really was.
"Daddy, please tell me where you are."
Even though the voice was low and guttural, he could still recognize his daughter's speech pattern. He'd had her, too. Whatever they were, his daughter was now one of them. The two people he loved in this world were gone, and there was only one way to be with them again. He stood up and looked at the thing one last time. It didn't really look like his wife anymore, but he tried to imagine her standing there, like she often did in the mornings, a cup of tea in one hand. He ran towards the back door and threw himself against it, breaking it and falling outside onto the sleek grass. Raindrops started hitting him immediately, one of them landing on his cheek, the rest across his arms and back. Soon, he was standing in the rain with his face towards the sky, like a little kid playing, trying to catch raindrops with his tongue. It didn't take long. Demons. What are they? How do they operate? And how does one cast them out? Many years ago, famous Christian apologist C.S. Lewis said there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors. It's been decades since he said that. The church is still battling with these equal and opposite extremes. We have people who believe that demons and deliverance teachings and practices are a wish-wash emotional razzmatazz used to fleece people into an undue advantage. They believe that once we become new creatures, those old things are passed away, that demons have no more power over the believer's life, that all we need to do daily is to renew our minds and live wholly to please the Lord. On the other hand, there are those who practically live, talk, and smell demons. It's all about demons and nothing else. They believe that all of their problems in life are from demons. They spend hours binding and casting demons, running to and fro for one deliverance or the other. This book provides the right balance needed to deal with demons, overcome them, and live a victorious life. 20 Commonly Asked Questions About Demons by Daniel C. Okpara, narrated by Weird Darkness host Darren Marlar. Hear a free sample on the audiobooks page at WeirdDarkness.com. Cyst by David Gresky. Dr. Jerome Benzer was the third physician to examine the cyst on Sean's head in the last week. Benzer, protective goggles covering his eyes and a disposable surgical mask over his mouth and nose, poked at the knob with a gloved hand. The growth yielded beneath his fingertips, like potter's clay.
"Sean, how long have you had this?"
"I really don't remember. It never really bothered me, so I didn't think about it much," Sean said.
"Is it bothering you now?" the doctor pressed on the growth. Sean winced, not out of pain, but surprise.
"No, it's just grown so much in the last couple of months, it's become a nuisance."
"Has it ever broken through the skin? Has there ever been any drainage?"
Benzer grabbed a paper tape measure from a plastic bin attached to the wall. He stretched the tape across the cyst. 4.2 centimeters, about the diameter of a golf ball.
"No, but sometimes I feel it moving."
The doctor chuckled.
"That's not possible. A cyst is nothing other than a closed pocket of cells containing liquid, pus, or other foreign material. The fact that you feel it moving is just your imagination."
The doctor flopped back in his chair, his thin body being dwarfed by the piece of furniture. He lowered the mask off his face and pushed the goggles to his forehead.
"What I'm going to do is numb the area, open the cyst, and cut out the offending tissue. I'll cauterize the wound to staunch the bleeding and suture it closed. 20 minutes tops, and you'll be on your way home."
"Will it hurt?"
"Other than the initial prick of the injection, you won't feel a thing."
"All right, let's do it."
"Before we begin, Sean, I'm just curious, why did the other doctors you've seen refuse to treat you?"
"I don't know. They didn't say, but there was something in their eyes that told me they were afraid."
"Afraid? Of what?"
"I don't know, Doc. Maybe they felt it move?"
Dr. Benzer stood and pushed the small white button on the wall to page a nurse for assistance. While waiting for the nurse to arrive, he took a vial of Novocaine from the cabinet and filled a syringe with the colorless liquid. The nurse entered the exam room. Unlike the doctor, who wore street clothes instead of a blue smock, Nurse Kelly was dressed in the traditional white uniform. She carried a clipboard in her left hand. Sean presumed it was his medical chart and a surgical mask in the other. Nurse Kelly glanced at the clipboard a final time and, satisfied, set it on the desk.
"Hello, Sean," she said. "I see we're here for a little slice and dice this morning."
Sean did not find the nurse's sense of humor amusing. Nurse Kelly patted the padded, paper-covered exam table.
"Get your skinny butt over here and let's see what we've got."
Sean moved from the chair to the exam table and hoisted himself onto the end. Nurse Kelly poked at the lump on Sean's scalp.
"Wow, that's a big one. You sure know how to grow 'em, Sean."
"Nurse," the doctor said, "a little respect, please."
"Sorry, doctor."
"Sean," the doctor said, "I want you to lay on your left side."
While Sean got in position, Nurse Kelly prepared the instruments used for the extraction. Scalpels, forceps, a pair of scissors, and a wicked-looking curved needle with a length of surgical thread hanging from the blunt end, plus several other instruments that looked more like torture devices than tools used for medical purposes. Once the instruments were neatly laid out onto the sterile blue cloth, the nurse wheeled the cart closer to the doctor.
"This is going to sting," the doctor said, touching the point of the hypo needle alongside the cyst. "Don't hold your breath. Breathe through it, and it'll be less painful. Ready, Sean?"
"Ready."
The doctor pushed the plunger, pumping the syringe of Novocaine into Sean's scalp. The patient stiffened only after the initial injection. Two more squirts numbed the right side of Sean's head. Dr. Benzer took the scalpel and drew it across the lump. The flesh parted like an eyelid, revealing the orb beneath it. The doctor made a second incision around the base of the growth. The skin rolled back like someone peeling a grape. Then Nurse Kelly's eyes grew, as large as eggs. She pulled the mask off her mouth and whispered,
"Doctor, what is it?"
"I don't know, Kelly," the doctor said, staring at what had just popped out of his patient's head. It wasn't a spider. It had too many legs. But a spider was the only way it could be described. Its bulbous body, covered in fine white bristles, was the color of spoiled milk. A triangular growth of what appeared to be bone sprouted from one end and served as a head. There were no eyes, just a pair of oversized mandibles jetting from the jaws of the creature, snapping in the air. A barbed stinger, about a quarter inch long, pulsed on the rear of the abdomen, a droplet of poison oozing from the end. The spider thing leaned forward, took a piece of Sean's scalp between its pincers, and yanked. It shoved the strip of flesh into its tiny mouth. Feeling the tug on his scalp, Sean asked, "How's everything going up there, Doc?"
"Just fine," Benzer replied.
He tried not to stutter as he watched the monster eat bits of his patient.
"A few more minutes and we'll be all good."
The doctor noticed the crack between the floor and the door. Whatever this thing was, it couldn't be allowed to escape. He had no idea what kind of disease or infection this creature carried.
"We can't let it out of the room," he whispered.
"Doctor, are you sure everything's all right?" Sean said. "There's an awful lot of whispering going on."
"No, things are not all right. There's a monster sitting on your head," the doctor wanted to say, but said, "Everything's fine." Then, "Nurse, the door."
Nurse Kelly moved slowly around the exam table towards the linen closet, standing in the corner of the room. She opened the door, grabbed a handful of towels and scrubs from one of the shelves, and wedged them under the door, sealing Benzer, Sean, and herself in the room with the creature. Sensing movement, the spider thing rose on a half dozen of its rear legs, shrieked, and jumped from Sean's head. It landed on the desk. The doctor gasped. Nurse Kelly screamed.
"What the hell is going on here?"
Sean bolted upright on the exam table. He touched the right side of his face. His fingers came away bloody. No surprise, the doctor had just sliced open his scalp. There was bound to be blood, but what was on the desk was the surprise. The atrocity scuttled across the desk, knocking the clipboard to the floor, frantically looking for an escape route. It jumped to the floor. The tiny nails on the tips of its legs clicked on the tile as it scampered towards the nurse.
"Look out!"
Benzer said, but his warning came too late. The creature attacked the nurse's ankle, raising its rear and plunged the stinger into her.
Immediately, her ankle swelled to twice its size. Nurse Kelly shook her leg, each jolt sending stinging pain through her wounded ankle. The creature lost its grip and tumbled across the room. It smashed against the wall, righted itself, and darted towards the nurse again.
"Doctor!"
the nurse wailed, rubbing her injury. Hot to the touch, she feared infection.
"The scalpel!"
Dr. Benzer reached around Sean and across the exam table and plucked a scalpel from the instrument cart. He threw it at the fiend. The blade turned end over end, missed its mark, and stabbed the baseboard. The monstrosity stopped, raised its head, and even though it was blind, turned in Benzer's direction. It screamed and sprang at the doctor. Benzer stepped aside. The horror buzzed past his ear and landed like a fly on the wall next to him. Benzer grabbed another scalpel, spun around, and stabbed the miscreation, pinning it to the wall like a bug in an insect collection. The creature wriggled to get free, but it was fixed, firm to the plasterboard. The immediate threat immobilized, Dr. Benzer turned to Nurse Kelly.
"I'm fine," the nurse said.
She had managed to pull a roll of gauze from the cabinet and had bandaged her wound.
"Take care of the patient."
Sean still sat on the exam table. The gaping wound on his head had stopped bleeding, but the right side of his face was caked with dried blood. His hair was dark with gore and stuck to his forehead in sticky clumps. Sean stared in disbelief at the thing impaled to the wall. Dr. Benzer used an antiseptic wipe to clean Sean's face. There was still a pink tinge to his skin, but at least when he left the clinic, it wouldn't look like he was wounded in some kind of battle. Sean's hair was another story. Benzer tried his best to wipe the drying blood from the strands. A good scrubbing with soap and water would be needed to complete the job. Before the Novocaine wore off, the doctor closed the patient's head wound. It took longer than anticipated. The creature had managed to eat quite a lot of the flesh around the perimeter of the opening. The doctor finished. Sean asked, "What is that thing?"
"I have no idea," the doctor said.
"Whatever it was, it stopped moving. I think it's dead now."
A viscous, black liquid ran down the wall, and the spider thing had turned the color of stone. The doctor looked at the creature.
"It certainly looks like it, but I think I'll leave it there for a while longer, just to be certain."
He turned to Sean.
"Is there anything else I can help you with today?"
"Yes, doctor. Can you take a look at these?"
Sean lifted his shirt. His chest was covered with cysts.
Thanks for listening. Feel free to email me anytime with your questions or comments at darren@weirddarkness.com. Darren is D-A-R-R-E-N. You can also find all of my social media and a link to the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group on the contact page of the website. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done so, and leave a review of the show in the podcast app you listen from. And if you're already a weirdo, please take a moment today and share the podcast with someone you know who loves paranormal stories, true crime, monsters, or mysteries like you do. You can also vote for Weird Darkness in the Hot 50 Countdown in Podcast Magazine every day I upload an episode. To vote, follow the link in the Essential Web Links section of the show notes or click on Vote at WeirdDarkness.com. Do you have a dark tale to tell of your own? Fact or fiction, click on Tell Your Story on the website and I might use it in a future episode. Stories in creepypasta episodes like this are works of fiction. Lady in White was written by Paul Spangler. Kingdom Come is by George Contronis. And Cyst was written by David Gresky. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Psalm 42, verse 11. Why are you downcast, O my soul? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise Him, my Savior and my God. And a final thought. Some things need a little time and space to evolve into what they're going to be for you. Don't force it.
let it flow. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness.